Thank you for attending session 327, titled Lost Tribes, From Lost Tribes to Mormon Humor, One Man's Faith Journey Through Mormon Folklore Studies. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This section is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for their session. Starting at BYU in the MTC, or in the Missionary Collection, sorry, let me start over. Starting at BYU in the Missionary Collection of the William A. Wilson Folklore Archives, continuing at Indiana University with a master's thesis on Japanese Mormon lost tribe lore, and ending with a half-finished dissertation on Mormon humor, Glenn reflects on his time studying and teaching Mormon folklore and the ways it impacted his family, his beliefs, and his faith. Glenn Oslin studied Mormon folklore at Indiana University and came half a dissertation away from finishing a PhD on Mormon humor. But he never really did anything with that, because really, what can you do with a PhD in folklore?
All right. I hope there's not going to be any reverb here from the microphone, but I'm going to record this myself and set a timer. I hope I get through everything that I wanted to present, but I'm not sure if I'm really going to have time to talk about everything I wanted to talk about in 40 minutes. And I was telling my mom that, you can't hear me? But I've got a booming voice. You can't hear my booming voice just by itself? All right. Well, let me start by asking, with a show of hands, who in here, you don't know who I am, or have ever heard any podcasting that I've done? You just saw this on the agenda and thought you'd come in. Okay, all right. That's good to know. All right, so as I introduce myself to you and get into this topic, you'll learn a little bit more about me. So as I was starting to say, I don't think I'm going to have time to finish everything. My mom, who's also here, Mom, and you can address in the question and A session. Yeah, in the Q&A session, you can address questions to her, too. She told me that was fine ahead of time. But she said, if only you had a podcast to finish the things that you weren't able to say during the presentation. And so that is the case. So I'm recording this, and if I have to supplement things with what I wasn't able to get to today, I'll do that, and I'll release it as part of the podcast. So for those who don't know, I've been involved in Mormon podcasting for a little over 6 years. I started with Mormon Expression and did that for a couple of years until I was fired. And now I'm working with Infants on Thrones, and have been doing that for 4 years. And as you mentioned in the introduction, master's and almost PhD, ABD in folklore. Something about me, I recently did a Myers-Briggs personality test. And I don't know if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs, but I am what is called an INTP, which means that I lean more towards introversion than to extroversion. I'm more intuitive than I am sensing. I'm more thinking than I am feeling. Sorry, Mom. And I'm more perceiving than I am judging. Here's what Wikipedia has to say about INTPs, that INTPs are marked by a quiet, stoic, modest, and aloof exterior that masks strong creativity and enthusiasm for novel possibilities. Their weaknesses include poor organization, insensitivity to social niceties, and a tendency to get lost in abstractions. So that kind of sums up who I am. And I saw something on Facebook a few weeks ago that I thought was very interesting. It was what it means when different Myers-Briggs personality types say, I love you. So when they say, I love you, what does that mean? So I want to share that with you. INTPs may not be the most showy or romantic lovers, but they display their devotion subtly by consistently trying to understand their partner and their needs better. This type enjoys analyzing and dissecting what makes their loved ones tick. And the more they love you, the more interested they will be in this process. When an INTP says, I love you, what they're really saying is that they're committed to getting to understand you better and better every day. So I do resonate with that. I think there's some truth to that. And so today, as I talk to you about my experience of going through graduate school and how I started off as a very faithful, active, believing Mormon, and I ended up in a very different place, I want to frame it as an act of love, because I loved the Mormon church, and I wanted to understand it better. And that was my motivation for making it a focus of study, really throughout my life. Now, when I was younger, I think there were a lot of things I loved about being a member of the church. But maybe first and foremost was I loved that it put me at the center of the universe, in a sense, that there was a plan that was created for me, that God knew me, I could talk to him, and I really felt that connection, and I loved how it gave me a sense of truth and knowledge that I had that non-Mormons didn't have, and that I had access to the promise of even more truth and knowledge to be found through diligent study and prayer, that there were hidden truths and deeper doctrines that I could explore and I could discover that even most of my fellow Mormons may not have discovered. So I want to give you a few examples of how I actually put that into practice. When I was an undergraduate at BYU, I was taking an English class, and we studied John Milton's Paradise Lost, which I thought was a fascinating poem, fascinating story about Lucifer's fall from heaven and then tempting Adam and Eve. And I thought, wow, this is great. There should be a Mormon version of this. And John Milton was so close. He got so many things almost right. So I started writing a book called The Fall. And I really wanted to get into this idea of what was it that made Lucifer fall? How did he start off as this noble son of the morning, but then turn into just the epitome of evil and the father of lies? What was that process like? So in trying to novelize this, I came up with all kinds of silly things. But what I ultimately decided was that Lucifer, being able to see the future, and kind of all of us could see the future in some ways in the pre-existence, saw that there was going to be this great pain where there would be a war in heaven. And it was a war over, you know, whether or not coming to this earth, we would have a veil of forgetfulness put over us. And Lucifer's position was that if we just came to earth to get the bodies and didn't have the veil of forgetfulness put over us, we'd all come back and it would be great. And that this was the way that Lucifer was taking away the agency of men. It was by saying, no, God's plan should be that we don't have the veil of forgetfulness. Then we'd all come back. And I thought, that's awesome. That's got to be right. I love that idea. So this is an example of those things that I would explore and think, yeah, I've got it. I've got it. There was other things as I was taking a geology class at BYU and learning about carbon-14 dating and how that didn't quite line up with the timeline of creation that we get scripturally. I thought, okay, so, and this is kind of complex, I'll see if I can get this out quickly, that carbon-14 is based on the assumption of a constant rate of decay, that then you can extrapolate back in time and say things decay at this point of time. But from what we've heard, what we've learned about the earth being created in a paradisiacal state, and then it fell into the state that it's in now, and Joseph Smith, when he would have visions. You would talk about being quickened by the Spirit, and that's the actual thing. Maybe the difference between a celestial and a terrestrial and a telestial state has to do with quickness or the speed of things, and that when the earth fell into this state, it slowed down. And so basically, they're, by trying to approach things with a constant rate of decay, it's a faulty assumption because things haven't always been constant. So carbon-14 can give you dates and results that really aren't. Anyway, this is what I thought. And I thought, oh, great, I've got the answer again. There were a few others that I just really don't have time to go into. But this is what I loved about being Mormon and about thinking things through and putting things together and connections. So I was at BYU, and I should also tell you, in my patriarchal blessing, I got this when I was 18, and among other things, it told me to get to know my brethren of the other tribes, for in due time you'll come to learn of them and to know of their culture. And I was always so interested in the Lost Tribes anyway, that really spoke to me, and I couldn't wait to find who the Lost Tribes were and exactly what role Heavenly Father had for me to find the Lost Tribes. I just was really knocked out by that. And it also told me to get as much education as I can because I'll need it in the future, and I'll need it in ways that today perhaps I know not of. And so I didn't really have a very strong academic goal, what I was going to school for. It was just enough to know that I was getting as much education as I could because I would need it in some way that the Lord knew and I didn't have to know, and that was okay. But I was at BYU kind of wondering what to do, and a professor said, well, if you want to know what to study, go to the library and check out a bunch of books and then see if there's a pattern that emerges. And I did that, and I found several books on folklore and was introduced to a man named Bert Wilson, William A. Wilson, who recently passed away, but a great guy, teaching folklore at BYU for many, many years, and started the Missionary Folklore Collection, or the folklore collection that's in the BYU library now. It's named after him. And so I went to work for him in the Missionary Folklore Collection, and that put me on the path to studying about folklore. And I was most interested in Mormon culture. But first, let me give you a little background into what folklore is. It's based, a lot of people think that folklore is about what's true and what's not true. So when they would hear that I was studying folklore, becoming a folklorist, they would share a story with me and say, is that true? You know, like I was a folklore detective or something. It's really understanding the role that tradition plays in human culture and in different ways that we express ourselves as human. And so tradition is typically defined as person-to-person communication or group-to-group communication that happens over geographic space. It happens over time. There's multiple variations of different things, and so you can tell that there's a traditional element to something. That's usually things are created and formed by a group of people and not just a single author. There are different types of folklore. There's oral folklore that, you know, where you have folk speech and folk tales and legends and myths and even personal narratives and all kinds of things like this. There's material folklore that has to do with traditional clothes and traditional food. Customary folklore that includes rituals that are done and beliefs that are done, magic and superstitions, and three patterns. If you've listened to the podcast, you've probably heard me talk about three patterns, which is just a way that we typically organize things because it seems to make sense to us. And the reason it makes sense is because we've culturally learned through time that three patterns make sense to us. And that there are different functions of folklore. So all of these different things can be used in different ways that are useful to people. So it's been proposed that there's four different functions of folklore, probably because they were trying to avoid a three pattern. The first one is entertainment, that it's a way of escaping from reality and dealing with the stress of everyday life. Another function of folklore is validating culture or validating beliefs. A third could be, folklore could be used as a teaching tool where you're communicating cultural norms and appropriate behavior, the do's and don'ts, if you will. Or fourth, it could be a way of applying social pressure and having social control over groups of people. And so I need to back up for a minute, because the very first lecture that I sat in on with Bert Wilson about folklore, he put this slide up on the board that was called a saltbox house. Any of you know what a saltbox house is or what it looks like? You've got a standard house that you would think of like a Monopoly house, and then off the side of the house there's a little slant. Okay, and that's a design that originally came in New England, and there's reasons why, and then it migrated as people moved west, and you see them here in Utah, and there's different variations of a salt box house, but it's an example of traditional architecture and how this design continues. As soon as I left that lecture and I was walking back home to my apartment, I started seeing salt box houses everywhere, and these are houses that I had walked by who knows how many times and had never noticed the design of this house or being able to classify it as being a particular type of traditional architecture. But after having that lecture, I couldn't not see them anymore, and that really impressed me. So as I was learning about folklore and culture, traditional culture, all these things that I talked about, I started seeing these everywhere. These were other salt box houses that popped up in my life. Let's see, how am I doing on time? Okay. And the thing that I learned about that, or that really struck me, was that if something is traditionally created or passed along, it's created by people. And so something that I've talked about and heard, I didn't create this term, but there's the fingerprints of humanity all over the creation of things. Because traditional culture is human expression. It's made by humans, and it's modified by humans, and it's used, and it's reused by humans. And it kind of connects us together by our shared human experience. And I remember an example of that early on. A teacher showed us these wooden shoes. And you can probably imagine in your head wooden shoes maybe from Holland that have the little point at the tip, and they'll have designs on the side of them. Well, Mexico also has traditional wooden shoes that have a tip at them and then designs on the side of them. And so you might look at that and go, oh, I wonder if there was contact between these cultures at some point where they were able to pass this knowledge from one person to another. Well, that's possible. That could be why these two different cultures that are set very different places in the world have a similar thing. But you don't want to discount that these are also both humans who have feet that need to be covered. And there's materials around that you can choose from. There's a limited amount of materials to choose from, but they have wood and designed, and it happens to be, it's a coincidence, but it's similar because it's human. And so that's another explanation for why there could be similarities between things. So this is the mindset that I went into as I started studying folklore at Indiana University and was learning these things and started turning this towards my Mormon culture, because I was learning these things about, you know, wooden shoes in other places and myths of other societies, and I started realizing there's similarities between these other groups and mine. And I got to a point where I couldn't feel comfortable giving one explanation for why it's like this in other cultures, but a different explanation for why it's like this in mine, or giving precedence to my own traditional learned beliefs and culture and not to others. So as I was studying this, it was a struggle as a graduate student coming to this realization. I felt a lot of pressure, because Indiana University, where I was studying, is not Brigham Young University, where everyone is immersed in this culture. I was an outsider at Indiana University that would have to justify why I believe certain things as a Mormon to people who aren't Mormon and aren't predisposed to just accept what I say, but they'll look at it critically and make me support it critically. And that was a very important lesson for me. And as it came time for me to write my master's thesis, I dipped into my past experience and my different interests and my different loves, and chose the topic of lost tribes, because I had always been interested in lost tribes, and as I mentioned, my patriarchal blessing talked about lost tribes, and I served a mission to Japan. And when I was in the MTC, maybe one of the first days I was in the MTC, I had a Japanese instructor, and she told us that the Japanese were the lost hidden tribes of Israel, and that at some point they, you know, the prophecies that the tribes would come back, that it was probably the Japanese. And she started giving us some reasons, and she showed us a red torii gate, which you've probably seen pictures of, or if you've been to even a Chinese restaurant or a Japanese restaurant, there'll be a gate and the ends are turned up like this, and it's traditionally red in color. And she asked us, "Why do you think it's red?" We had no idea. But it was a rhetorical question anyway. She knew the answer. It was because the Passover story from the Old Testament, the way that the Israelites were protected from the angel of death going through and killing all the Egyptian firstborn was to take the blood of a lamb and to paint it on the sides of the doorpost and on the top of the doorpost. And that was something that Israel people continued in memory, and it was passed down through their culture. And as the Lost Tribe group, you know, migrated after the Assyrian captivity and ended up in Japan, that was something that they continued. And it's what's called a survival in folklore, which I didn't know until much later. So she believed that the torii gates was an indication or a clue that the Japanese people anciently had their origins in Israel. And there were several. I came to find several of these clues, that the temples in Japan, the Shinto temples, would have a veil, like the Mormon temple has a veil. And the priests, wearing all white, would go to the veil and they would knock three times. And they would enter through the veil to get to the Holy of Holies. And there was a washing ritual, washing their hands as they went to it, which, you know, upon closer examination, this was more of a parallel to modern Mormonism and Japanese culture than really to ancient Israel and Japanese culture. But as a missionary, there was no distinction between the two, because we also were the lost tribes of Israel. We were Ephraim rediscovered and restored. My favorite of these clues from Japanese culture is called a mikoshi, which is a box that the Shinto priests will carry around like the Ark of the Covenant. And it's designed very similar to what you watch Indiana Jones and you see the Ark of the Covenant all in gold with the angels on top. These mikoshi look very much like that. And so that was another indication that the origin was found in Israel. So it was very compelling for me as a missionary. As a graduate student studying folklore, I had to force myself to be a little bit more skeptical. I still believed in those connections, but I couldn't show that to my professors. I couldn't approach my master's thesis as if I'm proving that this is a true connection, although that was still inside of me. I still really wanted to be able to make that connection, but I had to be more objective about it. And as I looked at it, I started to see in the stories, because I would interview Japanese members, I would interview missionaries who had gone to Japan, and I started to see in their attitudes that because they believed that the Japanese were the lost tribes of Israel, that if they were a Japanese person, their conversion to the Mormon church wasn't a rejection of Japanese culture. It wasn't a rejection of their heritage. It was a reclamation of it. It was restoring it. And as a Mormon missionary, it wasn't that you were going and you were participating in cultural imperialism. It was that you were restoring truth and you were part of this larger restoration narrative of Mormonism. And that was a really hard thing for me to grapple with, because I went, oh, but this kind of takes some of the truthfulness out of it. It gave me cognitive dissonance. But I put this together in a paper that I presented to the Mormon History Association many years ago. I don't remember what year it was, but it was in Tucson. And Lavina Fielding Anderson was in the audience and came up to me afterwards and said, I thought that what you presented was really fascinating, and I'd love to publish something like that in the Journal of Mormon History. And I had never been published, and that was something as a graduate student having an opportunity to publish I was really excited about. This is pre-Google, so I didn't really know anything about Levina. I didn't know her association with the September 6th. And when I went back to Bloomington and started writing this, somehow I found out that she had been she was an excommunicated member of the church. And I still had aspirations to go back to BYU and teach folklore at BYU and thought, oh no, if I publish this, I'm going to be blackballed, blackmarked, you know, I won't be able to do it. So I just dropped it. And now I look back and I laugh at that, but that's how I felt at the time. So that was my master's thesis. And I continued in that way for a long time, balancing this belief and the desire to believe against these new critical thinking skills and the pressure of having to justify my beliefs to other people with more than just circular reasoning and faith-based approach to it. Faith wasn't going to cut it in academia for my professors. And it was a little bit discouraging, but I still had these aspirations to come back to BYU and to teach folklore. And so for my dissertation, I chose the topic of Mormon humor because I like humor. I like funny stuff. Maybe you could say that I love funny stuff. And again, I'm an INTP, so what do INTPs do when they love something? They try to understand it better. So I thought this would be a way to understand what makes something funny. When somebody laughs, what does that actually mean? What are they saying about it and what's going on? How is humor used? What are the functions of humor? And just what does it mean? And as I started studying, I came across several theories into humor studies. And one, maybe one of the more prevailing theories, is called the incongruity theory, that the reason that people laugh at something is because you have expectations set up, and then there's something that violates the expectation, so it's incongruous with what you would expect is going to happen. And that act of incongruity is a surprise, and so that surprise elicits some laughter, and it draws attention to the incongruity, and that's one reason why things are funny, or people laugh. Another one is called the superiority theory, and this is the idea that you laugh at things that you feel superior to, that are beneath you, and that what that laughter, that expression of laughter actually is a sense of euphoria that comes from a sudden realization that you are better than something else or that you're not as bad as something else. So somebody slipping on a banana peel and falling on their butt and, oh, I'm glad that wasn't me, ha ha. You know, things like that. And then, of course, those functions of folklore that I talked about earlier also apply when you're talking about Mormon humor, that it could just be entertainment. That's why it's being told. It's an escape from reality. Or it could be that some message in the joke is validating the culture, or it's validating the beliefs in that culture. The humor could be a teaching tool. It could be telling you what the cultural norms are and the do's and don'ts. It could be ways of applying social pressure and keeping people in the in-group and keeping outsiders out of the out-group or in-group. So I'll give you a few examples of Mormon humor that I put in my dissertation, and you can analyze it yourself as you sit there listening to this, what you think applies. So here's one that's very simple. Why did the Lamanites have bruised legs? Anybody know? Why do the Lamanites have bruised legs? Yeah, because of all the Nephites. I didn't make it up. Here's one that's a little bit better, Tom. there was a guy who was kind of he was an inactive member of the church. He's a painter, and he was hired to come and paint a new temple that had just been built in the area. But he was kind of a cheapskate, and so he would give a quote, how much paint he would need, how much time it would take, and then he would water down the paint so he could stretch that and not have to, you know, he'd make more money that way. And so he went and he painted the temple, And a few days after he painted it, there was a big storm, and a lot of the paint ran off. So they hired him to come back and do it. He did it again, you know, again thinning down the paint. And then the rainstorm happened again. The paint came out. He came back a third time, because it always has to be three. And the a voice from the sky came down to this man and said, "Repaint, you thinner. Repaint and thin no more." You know, so what is going on in that joke? Is there an element? There's the entertainment, there's the laughter, there's validating culture. You can't cheat and get away with it for God. He's going to catch you. There's that message there, you know, et cetera. Things like that in that joke. Another one, there was a little Catholic boy that had a dog that had puppies. And the Catholic priest came by and saw the puppies and said, "Oh, these are great. Are these puppies Catholic?" And the boy said, "Oh, yes, of course they are, Father," and very happy with the response, he leaves. And he comes back a week later, and he asked the boy the same question. "Let me see the puppies. Oh, and these are Catholic puppies, right?" And the boy says, "Oh, no, 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 these puppies are Mormon." And the father is, "I'm confused. Why? A week ago, they were Catholic. What happened?" And the boy says, "Well, a week ago their eyes were closed, but now they are open." I like that groan that I heard. Yeah, that's the appropriate response. And it was jokes like this, and I think everybody here probably knows the one about the group of Mormons that are being toured through heaven and being told, "Be very, very quiet. This is where the Catholics are. This is where the Methodists are. This is where the Protestants are." Or no, and then we're getting to this. When we go over this hill, you've got to be very, very quiet because that's where the Mormons are, and they think they're the only ones here. You know, that there's this elitism that is either being reinforced in a joke, like the puppies and the Catholic, you know, their eyes were opened, and of course now they're going to be Mormon instead of Catholic, or a commentary upon the elitism that might make people feel uncomfortable that is being addressed in that heaven joke. And then this one was really kind of the nail in the coffin for me, because as I was part of my methodology for my dissertation is I had jokes like this, and I would read them to people in my ward, and then I would ask them to rate the joke. Did they think it was, you know, very funny, funny, not funny, offensive, and then ask them why. And that was just a way of getting them to talk about things so I could try to understand what was it that was going on here. And so I was sitting with a guy in the ward who had been a stake president, had served as a missionary with his wife several times, and he was very august and wise. And I was telling him this following joke. I said, there's a bishopric that goes camping, and as they're sitting around the campfire, the bishop reaches into his backpack, and he pulls out a cup and some instant coffee, and he brews it, and he drinks it, and he says, "Guys, I'm sorry, but when I come out here in nature like this, I just have to have a cup of coffee." And he looks at the first counselor, and the first counselor reaches into his bag, and he pulls out a cigar, and he says, "Bishop, yeah, you know, when I get out here in nature, I just have to enjoy it with a great cigar. This is my vice, my one vice." And looks at the second counselor, and the second counselor says, "Yeah, I have a vice too." And he reaches into his bag and pulls out a beer, and he says, "When I'm out in nature, I just got to enjoy a nice beer." And then they look at the executive secretary, and he says, "Yeah, I have a vice too. I can't wait to get back to the ward and tell everybody what you just did." You know? And so I said this joke. Both this man and his wife and those that were there, they all laughed like you just did. And so there's the question of, what does that laughter mean? What's happening inside of your heads as you hear that and you respond with laughter? And he laughed. And so I asked him to explain, you know, rate it. What do you think? Very funny, funny, not funny, offensive. He goes, "Yeah, that's not funny." I was a little confused by that. And so I'll explain it. And he goes, "Well, you know, I've been a bishop. I know a lot of bishops. I've been in bishoprics. They're all good people. And you really shouldn't disparage them, even in, you know, lighthearted jokes. So, yeah, it's offensive. Change it to offensive. Change my answer to offensive. And so I really struggled with that because, on the one hand, he laughed. He thought it was funny. But he couldn't acknowledge that. There was something about it that he couldn't explain or acknowledge. And again, I'm thinking that I'm going to take what I've learned at Indiana University and go back to BYU and teach, but I'm going to run into this sort of thing where I can't really say what it is that I'm seeing and I'm observing, or that if I do, it's not going to be accepted or appreciated. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't finish the dissertation. I also went into a different career, and it was a good excuse to get out of it, because this was causing me so much turmoil. And I started feeling like an outsider. You know, one of the things, another concept in the study of folklore, part of the methodology is doing ethnology, where you're actually with the people that you're studying, and you become what's called a participant observer. So you're actually, you think of people who go and they live with African people in Ghana or something, and they're learning about their culture. As a participant observer, they're actually doing it. Well, that's how I looked at myself when I was starting off. Well, this is easy because I'm already a participant in Mormonism, so I'll just now become more of an observer in it. And what I did is I observed myself right out of it, and I loved myself right out of it, because as I started seeing things and I started understanding them differently than I did before, I started seeing that I would have these observations that would lead to questions that there weren't any answers to. And the most frustrating thing was there were times when there wasn't even an attempt at answering it or addressing it. It was just, well, there are a lot of things we don't understand, but someday we will, and so let's just, you know, have faith in it. So there were several things like that I experienced in my ward as I was going through this, and I've talked about some of these on the podcast that maybe about half of you have heard. So one of the things that was really telling for me at this time, I was teaching gospel doctrine, which I really loved doing. And we were studying the Doctrine and Covenants, and it was the section about the degrees of glory, which I think is 76. And I wanted to really get into the degrees of glory and to go back to Joseph Smith's source material for that and the Joseph Smith translation that's in 1 Corinthians 15. And, you know, the footnote on that introduces this word telestial. You know, first I tried to find the word telestial. It doesn't exist anywhere except inside of Mormon culture. It's an invented word. And it doesn't really mean anything, whereas celestial means heaven. And terrestrial means earth. You know, I went to an elementary school called Kyrene del Cielo, which Cielo is a cognate of celestial. It means sky. It means heaven. And I'd never put that together until I was studying this for a gospel doctrine class, but having been a graduate student learning all these tools of critical thinking and trying to find, you know, more rigorous studying approaches. So I really had a problem with this, and I saw that what was happening in Corinthians is there's this question of, is there really a resurrection or not? And so there's this dual parallel structure that's being set up of there's things in the earth and there's things in heaven. And the things in the earth are corruptible, and the things in heaven are incorruptible, and, you know, there's imperfection and perfection. It's this binary structure throughout that section. And at one point, there's in this parallelism, they're saying that there's different types of earthly flesh. There's man, there's beast, there's fish, there's birds. And there's many different types of heavenly bodies. There's sun, there's stars, there's moon. And I went, wait, so the sun and the stars and the moon are all celestial. They're all part of the heavenly thing. It's not that the sun is celestial and the stars are telestial and the earth is, you know, it just blew my mind. And I went to anybody that I thought in the church to explain, how could this be that the Joseph Smith translation just sticks in, you know, there's bodies terrestrial and celestial. And he goes, and telestial. How does that fit with the Bible? But anyway, so that nobody could explain this to me. And, you know, it might seem like a little thing, but to me it made me go, do I understand 1 Corinthians 15 better than Joseph Smith did? Am I smarter than Joseph Smith? You know, there's no possible way that I could be smarter than Joseph Smith. Even though I'm getting a PhD, I have a privilege and opportunity that he didn't have. So it was one of those things that started stripping away the authority of, you know, the priesthood authority and lines in the church. At any rate, there were other things like that. When I was preparing for a primary lesson to teach, and it was the story of Moses when he lifts up the brazen serpent for the people that have been bitten, and this is what's going to heal them in their faith. That story is retold in the Book of Mormon. But there's one detail that's very different. In the Book of Mormon, this serpent on a stick has wings. It's a fiery flying serpent. It's not a flying serpent in the Old Testament. It's just a serpent. And so I'm asking myself, so the Book of Mormon's supposed to be more true than the Bible. So were there really flying serpents back then? No, I don't think that's right. We'd find that in the archaeological record. And there weren't flying serpents. So what's the explanation for this? Well, you know that sign for the medical association? There's one where the serpents just twist around a pole and that's it. There's one where the serpents have wings. Now, the ones where the serpents have wings actually comes from Hermes, and it comes out of Greek, and it's not really meant to be used for medicine. It's meant to be used for commerce and sometimes fraud. But when it came to the U.S. at first, it was mistakenly adopted and applied to the medical wing because of the biblical story. And that mistake, I determined, filtered into Joseph Smith's imagination. And so as he's retelling this story in the Book of Mormon, now the snake has wings. So, you know, going and asking people, why does the snake have wings in the Book of Mormon but not in the Old Testament? It doesn't matter. Well, if this is an indication that Joseph Smith was making up the Book of Mormon, I think it kind of matters. But maybe we just don't want to think about it. So these were the kinds of things. Another thing, the Tower of Babel. I could look at the Old Testament and say the Old Testament is a group of folk tales. And that makes sense to me. But the Book of Mormon is divine word of God. And I was able to make that distinction until I went, but the Book of Mormon forces a literal interpretation of the Tower of Babel on you with the brother of Jared and that whole story. So I can't take the position that the Old Testament was just folklore. It was just a way of ancient people explaining why there's different languages in the world. So at any rate, there were all kinds of things like that. So the conclusion, I loved myself out of Mormonism. And it's not that I don't still love it. I still do. And that's what drives what I do with Infants on Thrones. And these great people my friends that we get on and we talk and we record our conversations, trying to understand things better. Me taking on the role of TBM whisperer from time to time. It's an homage to that self of mine that I loved, but I started seeing that these salt box houses were man-made. They weren't divine. The Mormon salt box house isn't a temple that's divinely engineered. It's got the fingerprints of humanity all over it. And just like with the salt box houses, I couldn't not see it once I had learned that. So, anyway, that's the end. You heard the buzzer. I pretty much got through everything. I raced through it, but I'll add a little bit more to this and publish this as an episode at some point. But I want to thank you all for coming out. It's really nice to see you all here, and very happy to take Q&A now. So thank you.
I guess I got the first question.
Yeah.
So my question is, what do you think the purpose of this story is? It seems to get a pretty good laugh from ex-Mormons and returned missionaries and maybe a little bit of uncomfortable chuckle from active Mormons. But the story goes that a Jewish rabbi goes into a barbershop, gets his hair cut, the barber cuts his hair, and the rabbi goes to pay the bill and he says, "Oh no, you're a man of God, no charge." And the next day, the Jewish rabbi comes back with some flowers to thank the barber for his kindness. Then the next day, a Catholic priest comes in, gets his hair cut, and the barber, he goes to pay the barber. He says, "No, you're a man of God, no charge for you." And The next day, the Catholic priest brings back a plate of cookies to thank the barber for his kindness. And the next day, two Mormon missionaries come in and get their hair cut. And he cuts their hair and says, no, you're a man of God doing God's work, no charge. And so what do you think the Mormon missionaries bring back the next day? Anybody?
Know.
Four more missionaries.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. My question is, what is the... Is that kind of a teaching, a cultural commentary, maybe a little ouch, maybe there's some truth to it?
Yeah, yeah. To really understand it, and thank you for sharing that. I think to really understand it, I'd need to know who's telling it to who, and because I don't want to make it seem like there's one answer, this is what it is in every situation. It could be used in a number of different ways, and that would depend on the people that are saying it. But I would say my reaction to that would be that, first of all, Mormons love to hear Mormons in any kind of a joke or something like that. It's just, it really tickles us to know, oh, yeah, people are talking about us. We exist alongside of a Jewish rabbi and a Catholic priest and a Mormon. That puts us in really good company. We've arrived. We're a people. So there's that kind of cultural validation there. And then also an awareness that, missionaries do come back. You know, there's kind of a pushiness to missionaries that I think that members are a little bit aware of and uncomfortable of, and so that may be a commentary there. It could be that people think that cookies or what the other gifts are aren't really that great of a gift, but coming back with more missionaries, that's great, you know, so that's a good thing. And so I think there's a lot of different ways I'd have to talk with people, but thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Glenn. That was a great presentation. I was curious, I'll tell it and then the joke and then ask you a question.
Okay.
So there's two non-Mormons here in Salt Lake that happen to, one just moves in and the other's been a long-time resident. And so they're talking about fishing here in Utah and how great the fishing is and everything. And the one guy who's lived here quite a while says to the other guy, when you go fishing with your Mormon friends, you always want to make sure and take two with you. Never just take one. Mm-hmm. And the new guy says, well, why?
Can I finish the joke for you?
But yeah.
Everybody, one, two, three, they'll drink all your beer.
They'll drink all your beer. Right. If you take one, he drinks all your beer.
Yeah.
So, and...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I skipped ahead. Go ahead, Joe. Finish the joke.
Okay. So if you just take one, he'll drink all your beer. So if you take two, if they won't drink, you know, your beer. So
yeah.
And so anyway, in your one about the bishopric, mm-hmm. as I was hearing it, my reaction was that's never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But with the two, you know, the story about the two Mormons versus the one Mormon, that's something that could happen. And so at least it's closer to realism. And and for me, when I went to the Comedy Store in L.A., I used to go all the time. My wife and I would go all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hollywood there. And I would sit there, and some of the guys, I wouldn't laugh at all.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, Andrew Dice Clay... Yeah. Used me as his prop one night.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't laugh.
Yeah.
I just, you know. But then another guy who wasn't famous, I laughed the entire time. But his were real. So it seems to me that, and that's why parody works. Because the closer you're to truth, the more you laugh, I think.
Well, and again, I mean, I think another thing in humor studies that was a challenge for me is that humor is very subjective, you know. So you weren't laughing at Andrew Dice Clay, but other people were. And why was that? Yeah.
That's why he was using me as a spirit.
Right, right.
Because for some reason, he asked me what religion I was. He found out I was Mormon.
Mm.
And so he just focused on me better.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think the example where the bishopric are camping, that's really a joke about gossip. And that there are these very superficial transgressions that are, you know, fit in the word of wisdom that people pay a lot of attention to, but they don't with gossip, but it's just as prevalent, it's more prevalent. And to me, that's what that joke says to me, and that's what's being called out there. It's not really about realism as much as it's representing what are the values in Mormonism. So it's a critique on that, I think. But at any rate, thank you for the comment, Joe.
Thank you. In your studies, did you ever investigate the folklore surrounding Mormon racism?
Yeah.
You know, this nonsense about Mark of Cain and, being valiant in the pre-existence and all of this that was taken so seriously by Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, Joseph F. Smith, right down to Joseph Fielding Smith and, every general authority, with the exception of maybe one, and now the church has reached the point where they're disavowing this, trying to reinvent themselves, and actually on their website calling it folklore.
Yeah. Well, and it is folklore, but I think the thing that I came to in studying folklore is that there really isn't anything that isn't folklore. So, as you know, if folklore is defined as traditional things that are learned behavior from other people, that's a great way of saying, okay, this is a traditional belief that existed before Mormonism. It came into Mormonism and it took on a Mormon flavor because now this is the group that's using it as a way of justifying the practice of excluding blacks from the priesthood. And so you can see the way that folklore exists in multiple variation, and you can explore why there's the variation and why people are doing it, what the value is. And now there's an emphasis to change that traditional belief, but it doesn't mean that it's not being combated with other traditional beliefs, or that there's an attempt to introduce new beliefs that become traditional beliefs or anything like that. I hope that was a good enough answer for you. And I think we've only got time. We got about 5 minutes.
Okay. I'm curious about the extent to which you see what you all do on Infants on Thrones as a kind of continuation of Mormon humor and building on that, or a departure from it.
Yeah.
Having listened to most of the podcast, you use a lot of humor.
Yeah.
And it's typically done to challenge authority, to mock authority, to destabilize authority. I'm coming at this as somebody who's never been Mormon.
Right.
I'm a historian of everyday life under communism, and what you see in communism is like humor was a huge outlet for people to be able to express displeasure with authority, challenge authority in a kind of safe way. You had to know who you're telling the joke to, right? But in situations in which authority could not be challenged directly.
Yeah.
And so when I'm thinking about, okay, what do these guys do? And, like the all the songs, the fake address is delivered on Boyd K. Packer.
You're trying to get me to do Boyd K. Packer, aren't you?
I wouldn't mind. So
I don't do
are
a
y'all
very
doing
good
Mormon
Boyd
humor,
Packer.
Or
there's
are you
other
doing
people
something
do
else?
Well, so thanks, Patrick. Let me comment on that a little bit. One of the things that Bert Wilson, who was the mentor, the folklorist at BYU, he wrote some pieces about Mormon humor, and he talked about this thing called psychic distance and I'm trying to remember what he said about it, but that the reason that if people are too close to something, they won't find humor in it, and that there has to be first some psychic distance in order to appreciate and to laugh at something. And I don't disagree with that, but I think that humor can actually be a tool that creates that psychic distance as well. And I don't think that's anything that intentionally is being done by any of us that do Infants on Thrones, but come back in this room at 2:00. We've got a panel discussion and we'll have a Q&A. You can ask everybody else. I think it's just a reflection of our personalities and what we enjoy and what we appreciate doing, and it happens to scratch that itch that other people have, and it functions in these ways. But for me, it's just because of fun, and the reason I wanted to do a dissertation on humor in the first place was because I like humor, and you know, that's just part of who I am and always have been. And I think the other guys would and Heather would agree as well. But yeah, we'll talk about that later.
I was raised on three Nephite stories, near-death experiences. In some cases, these stories were more faith-promoting than Mormon scripture. And so I was curious if there have been any good books or essays written on like the history of these types of stories, their influence on the Mormon culture and the origins of them, things like that.
I don't know off the top of my head. I'll have to think about it. You know one, Joe? It's coming back.
Sunstone actually has a whole issue dedicated to Mormon humor and Mormon folklore. So it's like you call it, and it's on the cover, it says that. So unfortunately, you're going to have to go back and just look at it.
Okay. Thanks. All right, we're out of time. This is Tom Perry, everyone.
Hey.
Tom Perry. Forget the L.
Hey, Glenn. Yeah. Used to be a big fan.
Used to.
So, two questions. One, nitpicking humor. Doesn't that kill it?
Yes.
And then two, thank you for the quick answer.
Yes.
Two, what is the most appropriate way to acknowledge that the joke wasn't funny? Is it a sigh?
It is a sigh.
Silence?
Maybe a groan? I think you could probably demonstrate for everyone here exactly how that sigh...
Well, I gave one earlier. Yeah, there you go.
Tom Perry, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. And just final words. You know, Matt Long is going to be here next. One of the things we asked Lindsay when we were setting up, you know, planning for Sunstone, we asked her if we could all present in the same room. And recognized, she said, well, I was actually going to put the infant panel in the Saltaire room because it'll seat more people. And I said, well, I think I'd rather have us be together. That may have been a mistake. We'll find out at 2 o'clock. But I just wanted to acknowledge that's on me if that's a mistake. But in this room, it's going to be almost all infants all day. So we had John before me. We've got Matt next. And then there will be a lunch break. We'll be here or just right outside the booth where we're selling T-shirts. And Jake, is Jake in here? Or his presentation isn't in this room. It's somewhere else, but it's after the panel discussion. So, for those that are infant fans and want to stick around, thank you again. And buy a shirt.